May it please the court, counsel. I'm Chris Ingold, appearing on behalf of the plaintiff below, Tomas Gonzalez, appellant herein, and also appearing on my own behalf pro se, since the trial court judge awarded attorney's fees and costs against me personally. Although section 1381 103, subsection 1, subsection A, speaks in terms of the running of the applicable statute of limitations against a person under disability represented by a, quote, legal representative, close quote, and not in terms of suspending or tolling the limitation period during the period of disability, there can be no question that the statute is intended to toll the applicable statute of limitations during the period of disability. Otherwise, there would be no purpose in setting forth the conditions for removing the disability as section 1381-103 clearly does. The provisions of section 1381-103 therefore operate to suspend the running of the applicable statute of limitations until either the disability is removed or, as expressly provided in subsection 1A, a quote legal representative, close quote, is appointed for the, quote, person under disability.
Mr. Ingold, I'm not sure that there's a real dispute that as to whether or not the statute of limitations is told for a person under disability, but rather the significant question is, how do you determine whether someone is under a disability under the statute? What is your answer to that?
You don't do it as the trial court when a jury has been requested. I don't mean to be flip in my response, Your Honor, but I think the court cases are extremely clear on that. And what I was just stating to Your Honors are not my words. Those are the words of the Colorado Supreme Court in the Southard v. Miles case. And I believe the well-established nature of the tolling of a statute of limitations for a person under disability and the need for any factual question to be resolved by the trier of fact, the jury, and not by the trial court judge, is one of the principal reasons why the Rule 21 petition to the Colorado Supreme Court was not granted.
Let me focus on this issue, if I may.
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you agree that the statutory phrase about a person under a disability does not refer to someone with a physical disability?
I would agree, Your Honor.
Okay, then if it refers presumably to someone with a mental disability, who is to determine to what extent of a mental disability there must be before the statute is triggered?
I believe the statute is triggered by its own operation, by operation of law. But the question of discerning whether the statute has been implicated and the statute of limitations told, I believe, is a question for the trier of fact. If this were a trial to the bench, then I believe the trial court was well within their right to go ahead and decide the issue of whether there was a disability or not sufficient to toll the running of the statute.
Well, but does there have to be some kind of threshold showing from a person claiming to be under a disability saying either A, I have a mental illness, or B, because of my disability, I am not able to comprehend what's going on and understand the nature of the case?
I think certainly the issue has to be crystallized to a certain extent before the trial court could be expected to be cognizant of it. And in this instance, it was actually pled in the complaint, and it was supported by affidavit. And there was no contrary evidence presented of any kind at any time. What the defendants did, and I have to commend them on their ingenuity, was instead of presenting a counter affidavit, say from a medical doctor, which would have then required my client to get their own medical doctor or do some sort of factual disputing, rather than do a factual dispute, they turned the question of the disability into a legal question. And what they said is, hey, you had a work comp claim, And since you didn't raise this in your work comp claim, you should be stopped from raising it here.
Well, counsel, whose burden was it to establish the legal disability, yours or theirs? Because you went first and didn't provide medical evidence or a medical affidavit. They then decided not to as well, but was it their burden or was it your burden to establish a legal disability?
Well, it was, thank you, Your Honor, it was a motion for summary judgment. And so they had the typical burden under, you know, all the law dealing with summary judgment to show that there is no material fact at issue and that those being the facts, legally they were entitled to the relief requested, which was summary judgment. In response, what was pointed out, and it was the defendant's burden, was there is a material fact in dispute. As seen in the affidavit, there is a disability. Now, in their reply, what they could have done is they could have said, well, that's not a genuine issue of material fact. Here's our affidavit from Dr. XYZ whatever. And they could have said, we don't think that this is a genuine issue of material fact. They didn't do that.
Were you required to come forward with a medical affidavit or some kind of evidence to that effect to show that there was a legal disability?
The client's affidavit was sufficient.
Mr. Ingold, isn't there an anomaly between in what happened here and having Mr. Gonzalez submit his own affidavit saying that he was under a disability? I mean, if in fact the statute contemplates somebody being disabled to the extent of not being able to recognize the circumstances or being able to participate in the litigation of his or her case, I'm not sure how a litigant could present his own affidavit to establish that.
I would agree in almost every circumstance except this one. Let me explain why. My client suffered a low back injury. Then he had failed back surgery syndrome, which means they couldn't do anything with surgery except make the situation worse. He was left in chronic, unrelenting pain. He was maintained on massive amounts of narcotics as a result of that pain. When I first met my client, I thought the guy was drunk. And every time I talked to him, I thought he was drunk. Now, we got something implanted, which was a spinal pump that was able, instead of orally, to administer the narcotics and the analgesics, to administer it just to the spinal cord. Well, that helped a lot. And within a few months, his mentation cleared. At that point, I would argue he was relieved of his disability. But these are all factual questions. And they were addressed in the complaint. They were addressed by the affidavit. There was no evidence to the contrary. But I would agree with Your Honor. I think in most circumstances, a person who is or has been under a disability, if they're not competent, how could they swear out an affidavit? My client, though, and he clearly set it forth at depositions, he clearly set it forth in the complaint, when he got that spinal pump implanted, the delay of which was part of the bad faith, because they delayed in providing that pump for years. That delay was part of the bad faith. When he finally got that implanted, his mentation cleared, and I would say the statute began running. And he was then able to assist with his with evaluation of his claims and prosecution of his claims. That was not the only basis on which the court granted summary judgment, I believe, incorrectly, with all due respect. The judge also stated that any ongoing bad faith within 2 years of the filing of the complaint was gone because it hadn't been filed earlier. Well, as an illustration by example, the insurance company within the past month has delayed the payment of a TTD check, a temporary total disability check, causing massive hardship to my client this month. So is that forever gone? The judge found he didn't file bad faith soon enough, so I guess they can make those checks come late whenever they want.
Mr. Engel, do you not have to make specific allegations in the pleadings as to what are the discrete dates of the alleged bad faith?
The statement in the complaint, and it, we didn't do field code pleading, we didn't, the complaint is actually a bit more than notice pleading. I mean, it's pretty specific. It does allege an ongoing practice of late payments of checks. And I would submit that the Harmon case was different. The Harmon case is looking at, like, okay, in the medical malpractice context, as long as that doctor is still treating you, your statute's not going to run. It's only when he abandons you and he gives up treating you that no longer you've got to file within that period of time. It's the ongoing course of care. I agree that does not apply to bad faith. But each discrete instance of a late check should start a new period of statute of limitations as regards that bad conduct. These then were issues that should not have been resolved by, as a factual nature, by the trial court judge. And the trial court judge, I submit, incorrectly resolved the factual predicates of the fraud claim as well. And once she resolved the fraud claim adversely and the whole case was gone, then she turned and said, well, there's no basis to impose costs or attorney's fees as a discovery violation. There's no basis to award attorney's fees for a violation of the frivolous vexatious statute. Oh, wait a second, yes, there is. And then finally, on reconsideration, maybe it has something to do with costs. There's this moving target in the law of the case in terms of what the judge was actually explicating. And
Mr. Engel, if I could come back to your point about the statute of limitations for bad faith claims and the Harmon case. Judge Rappaport said that the only claims that she discerned that were alleged within the past 2 years or within 2 years prior to your filing of the complaint were the ones, the fraud claims that were alleged in paragraph 52. And in your briefs, you disagreed with that, but I'm not sure I saw in your briefs any specific statements about other specific allegations that you had made in your complaint in that regard. Were there any?
Yes, and in the reply, I will point you to the specific discrete facts in the reply, if I can reserve the balance of my time.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. I'm Doug Thomas. I represent Ms. Roden, Ms. Chowdhury, and Cannon Cochran Claims Management Services. We are the co-defendants in this matter. Try to reserve about half the time for my other co-defendant here. Let's just outline the fact pattern to make sure we have it very momentarily with regards to the procedural issues, which is that the trial court dismissed three of the claims on 12b-5 motions, that is the CCPA claim, the claim for breach of fiduciary duty, and without prejudice, the claim for punitive damages. The trial court then issued a order granting partial summary judgment on the statute of limitations for the remainder of the tort claims, which are the bad faith claims, the breach of contract claims, the civil conspiracy claims, and part of the fraud claims. The trial judge then allowed the remainder of the fraud claims, which were alleged within 2 years, to go forward. Discovery was completed, and then a final summary judgment was filed on the fraud claims, which the trial court granted as well, thereby dismissing all the claims stated in plaintiff's complaint and making the judgment final. So with that in mind, it's needless to say that I fundamentally believe that the trial court, Judge Rappaport, permitted the plaintiff to go forward with any claim in which they could establish that was in their complaint that the actions occurred within 2 years. So we disagree with the plaintiff's statement in their briefs, and again here at oral argument, that somehow the trial court dismissed bad faith claims for discrete acts occurring within 2 years. That's not what's stated in the trial court's order. What she stated is all claims outside the statute of limitations were barred. Any claim based on a discrete act within that 2 years was permitted to go forward. and then later dismissed on a separate summary judgment motion.
Well, Mr. Thomas, though, in her reconsideration of the motion to dismiss, isn't it true that Judge Rappaport only allowed the fraud allegations in paragraph 52 to go forward?
Absolutely true, and that's because those were the only allegations in the complaint where discrete acts occurred within 2 years of filing of the complaint. That's
so
true.
I take it you're disagreeing with Mr. Ingold in that regard.
I do. I don't think that's borne out by the record or by the judge's order. Any allegations in the complaint in which a discrete act occurred within 2 years, the judge permitted to go forward and did not dismiss on the basis of statute of limitations. She later dismissed it on the merits, but did not dismiss it on the statute of limitations. And she clearly outlined in her motion for clarification, she issued an order clarifying exactly which allegations occurred within 2 years and which allegations occurred outside of 2 years and which claims were barred by the statute of limitations and which claims could proceed forward. She did not make a blanket statement that everything is barred because the first act occurred outside of 2 years. That is absolutely not her ruling. Let me move forward then to the partial motion for summary judgment, which dismissed the claims on the statute of limitations. Clearly, it is the defense's burden to show that the statute of limitations began to run, and that is that the plaintiff, Mr. Gonzalez, and his attorney knew or should have known in this context, knew or should have known that workers' compensation benefits were being denied. Here, we don't have to worry about the should have known. We have actual knowledge that they believed the benefits were being denied because the attorney and Mr. Gonzalez wrote letters to the third-party administrator that workers' compensation benefits were being denied, filed pleadings in front of the Office of Administrative Court alleging that those benefits were being denied and being denied inappropriately, and actually litigated the issue of benefits and the wrongful denial before the Office of Administrative Court. So clearly we have actual knowledge which would commence the running of the statute of limitations. The burden then shifts to Mr. Gonzalez as the plaintiff to show any tolling. I know the co-defense, my client, cited in our answer brief the case of Garrett versus Arrowhead Improvement Association, Supreme Court case 1993, showing again the burden for tolling shifts to the person asserting it. That's Mr. Gonzalez. So it's clearly their burden in this case to show that they were mentally incompetent. Because we're dealing with that issue on summary judgment, the burden then shifts to Mr. Gonzalez to show through affidavits or other competent evidence that he was in fact mentally incompetent. That didn't occur here. There was nothing attached to his motion for summary judgment, or his response to the motion for summary judgment, which should show a basis that he was mentally incompetent. And I think if we go drill down here a little deeper, we're not just dealing with mental incompetence as kind of this generic gloss. We're dealing with it in the terms of, did Mr. Gonzalez lack the mental capability to understand that his workers' compensation benefits were being denied? And the answer is yes, unequivocally. There is no material fact about it because he had an attorney representing him, and he and that attorney made those statements to the Office of Administrative Courts. There's no material fact, which he's alleging in response to the motion for summary judgment, that would call into question his ability to understand that he was being deprived of workers' compensation benefits. He clearly and unequivocally knew it. He made those statements to another forum.
Is there a legal distinction between a legal attorney pursuing his workers' comp rights and a legal representative as it involves a legal disability?
There might be. In certain contexts, there might be. If we look at the statutory definition of legal representation contained in the statute of limitations, there's an introductory clause that says, unless the context requires otherwise. So I say that because I think here the context requires otherwise. Clearly in this case, Mr. Gonzalez, through his attorney, knew that workers' compensation benefits were wrongfully withheld. If we were to say that you need to have a probate court assign an attorney to protect Mr. Gonzalez's workers' compensation benefits, that would be superfluous in this case. It's superfluous because he already has an attorney protecting his workers' compensation rights, protecting his benefits, knowing that those benefits were withheld. So in this case, I think that the definition is one and the same. I think it's superfluous to suggest that he needs another attorney to do what his attorney is already doing. So could be in certain circumstances, not here.
Thank you.
Mr. Thomas, I also have a question about the affidavit. Is it your
position
that that is or is not competent evidence in when it was Mr. Gonzalez's burden at the summary judgment level?
I think our position here is a little different, Your Honor. Our position is whether it's competent or not, it fails to raise an issue of material fact. That is, no reason, in light of the conduct of the plaintiff, in light of Mr. Gonzalez and his attorney, making these allegations in the workers' compensation forum, proceeding with litigation in the workers' compensation forum, obtaining benefits in the workers' compensation forum, that no reasonable jury could conclude under those circumstances that he was incapable of understanding that those benefits have been deprived to him. That's what we're saying. No issue, no genuine issue of material fact here. Even if you credit it, and I understand that there's some difficulty crediting it because of the fact that at the one hand we're saying I'm incompetent, I'm mentally incompetent, and on the other hand signing an affidavit saying accept this as competent evidence, understand the inherent contradiction there. Our position is different. Our position is, regardless of whether you credit it or not, it fails to raise a material issue of fact which would deny summary judgment because no reasonable jury could reach that conclusion. So, I think I'm about halfway through here with my time. I'll turn it over to Mr. Foster.
May it please the court, I'm Adam Foster, number 35969, on behalf of Safety National. I'd like to briefly touch on three issues. The first, adding a little bit on the statute of limitations issue. The second being the fraud claim and its relation to the fee award in favor of Safety National and against Mr. Ingold. The third being Safety National's status as a specific excess insurer. I would submit that with regard to the statute of limitations, if one understands the factual timeline of this case, then the legal issues become much more clear. Specifically, Mr. Gonzalez had received almost a decade of medical treatment related to the workers' compensation claim from numerous different providers before the court ruled on the summary judgment issue related to the statute of limitations. Mr. Gonzalez did not come forward with a single medical opinion or medical record indicating that he was incompetent or under a legal disability. Now, counsel cited to the Supreme Court Southard case. In the Southard case, the court stated that the affidavits of the neurologist, cardiologist, internist, and rehabilitation specialist established that there was a triable issue of fact. And so Southard does require affidavits of medical providers to establish that someone is incompetent. In this case, also, there's the practical fact that in 2000, Mr. Ingold sent a letter to CCMSI accusing them of claims mishandling, which under the Brodeur holding shows that the statute of limitations should have begun running in 2000. The knowledge of Mr. Ingold was imputed to his client, Mr. Gonzalez. Similarly, in 2001, they instituted litigation for penalties in the workers' compensation case. Now, these penalties are up to $500 per day for each alleged violation. And so from a practical standpoint, the question is, what did the asserted legal disability keep Mr. Gonzalez from doing that a person without a legal disability would have done? And the answer is nothing. He hired an attorney who's a specialist in workers' compensation law and bad faith law, and they began to aggressively litigate claims for money from 2001 onward. There's also the holding of the trial court, which found that when Mr. Gonzalez took the stand in the workers' compensation proceedings and testified, when he accepted the settlement in the workers' compensation case, and when he litigated the workers' compensation case, that he, by taking those actions, asserted that he was competent to do all of those things, and therefore should be stopped from going back in the district court and asserting that he was incompetent. Now, Mr. Ingold stated that the defendants didn't present any evidence regarding competence. That's incorrect. The Safety National did present the affidavit of Kent Campbell, who is the workers' comp attorney for Fort Collins, and Mr. Campbell testified that Mr. Gonzalez never brought up, Mr. Engel or Mr. Gonzalez, no one in the comp proceedings ever brought up the question of legal competence at any point during the comp proceedings. Similarly, there's Mr. Gonzalez's own testimony in the workers' compensation case on March 17, 2006. Mr. Gonzalez testified under oath that after a few months he became used to the narcotic pain medications and that it did not prevent him from understanding what was going on in the workers' comp case or remembering the details of hearings in the case. With that said, I'd like to move on to the attorney fee issue. Oh, pardon me, briefly, to the extent that counsel is asserting that there were discrete acts, discrete bad acts that were committed within 2 years before the complaint was filed, he never articulated the when, who, and where of those alleged bad acts. So between the complaint and a motion for summary judgment, counsel was expected to develop evidence that would show if there was a misrepresentation, who made it, when it was made, what the misrepresentation was, and he did not develop that evidence, and that's why summary judgment was appropriate. Moving on to the issue of attorney fees and the fraud claim, from October 30th of 2006 on is the relevant period for the attorney fee issue, and at that point the only remaining fraud claim against Safety National was this claim of fraud based on the January 2005 partial settlement. Now, this court in a February 28th, 2008 order found that there upheld ALJ Haar and found that there was no violation of the Comp Act, no violation of the comp rules, and that the workers' compensation respondents, who were the defendants in the district court, had acted reasonably and in good faith with regard to payments pursuant to that settlement agreement. Similarly, ALJ Haar also found that Safety National was not a proper workers' compensation respondent. And the reason he found that is because they're a specific excess insurer, they are not a workers' compensation insurer. As an excess insurer, they had neither the right nor responsibility to control the amount or timing of payments to Mr. Gonzalez. And again, Mr. Engel, with regard to the fee issue, knew that ALJ Haar had made that ruling prior to October 30th of 2006. So then a reasonable attorney in his position would be expected to say, do I have any competent evidence to show that an employee of Safety National committed fraud? And yet he never submitted any kind of sworn testimony stating who made a fraudulent statement, when it was made, what the statement was, how Mr. Gonzalez relied on it. And that's why the district court correctly found that maintenance of the fraud claim after that point was groundless, because although the complaint stated a prima facie case for fraud, Mr. Engel did not develop any competent evidence in support of that fraud claim. Finally, with regard to Safety National's status as a specific excess insurer, I believe that ALJ Haar's October 4th order succinctly explains the difference between an excess insurer and a workers' comp insurer, but again, Safety National simply did not have the right or responsibility to control the payments to Mr. Gonzalez or to admit or deny its specific benefits. Safety National has requested its fees in conjunction with defending against this appeal, simply because if the claim in the district court was groundless, then the appeal is also groundless. Thank you.
Try to move quickly. The denial of penalties in the work comp system is irrelevant to bad faith. It may have some bearing in the face of a jury, but bad faith and a penalty issue are totally different, as upheld by the Vaughn case and the Broder case would also make that clear. What happened in the work comp recently regarding whether the settlement was timely made, those are issues regarding penalties, not whether a jury would find, well, yes, you got past the penalty issue, but they may not have gotten past a bad faith issue. We don't know because we haven't had a bad faith trial. The defendant, Safety National, excess insurer, what does that mean? They have documentation and oral admission of Safety National's participation in the settlement conferences. That's cited in the brief. They participated. I attached a transcript by way of argument, since they're arguing things that aren't in the record. I attached a transcript where at a recent hearing, the third-party adjuster says, yeah, I get my marching orders from the excess carrier and I do what they say. By way of argument, I'm pointing out that if it's not in the record, they shouldn't be allowed to argue it and let it just be accepted without challenge. In terms of whether the discrete lack of payment of indemnity was mentioned, it's in the complaint, on the first amended complaint at least, and I'm pretty sure in the first complaint as well, at page 3 and page 15, at paragraphs 14, 71, and 72, it's mentioned specifically in the affidavit that was attached to the August 2006 response to the motion for summary judgment filed by CCMSI. At page 2 of that affidavit, particularly at paragraph 4, but continuing on also to page 4 of that page 2 to 4 of that response, which mentions the affidavit and the things that are in the affidavit. And with all due respect, I think opposing counsel was confusing bad faith and fraud, different standards. I see that my time is up.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.